Ben Laurie, Reel 3. Would it be possible, do you think, for you to give an idea of what a, was there such a thing as a typical day, I wonder? But a typical shift, as near as possible, would have been for you what you did when you left your little digs, your billet, how you were picked up to the dropping you back at night. Would that be possible?
Let me see. How would I put that? Yes, fine. As the year wore on and we got towards the summer of 1945 and the end of the war, the piles of captured documents came in and increased hugely, and we were absolutely snowed under with translation work. The kind of things that we got through our hands were the details of the internal working of submarines, of rockets, of bombs, the aircraft in use and the development in progress. Nothing, but absolutely nothing, did I hear in those days about the conditions in which production was underway in Germany. It was purely either examples of the equipment that came our way, or alternatively and much more frequently, the documentation connected with them. Clearly, German research on technology, on war technology, which had been going on for a considerable length of time, was very far advanced. One would come out of the billet after an early breakfast and cross the road and wait for the coach coming in, and it stopped, you know, about in the villages, it stopped every 200, 250 yards to pick up the next little group of secretaries and filing clerks and code breakers and translators and so on and so forth. And we would eventually pass through the gates of Bletchley Park, where there would be a guard on duty in time to start work at 8 o'clock. Bletchley Park was a large estate. It, on the left as you went in was the old manor house, which was an unbeautiful building, still standing. Various parts of it had been converted for use as canteens, although by this time, of course, the service element of Bletchley Park had its own catering facilities. And so the catering in the emanating from the Mansion House would be for civilians only. And that was one of the places where one found contacts. That was a, it was a curious thing because given the intense secrecy, you never ever discussed outside the door of your section what went on behind that door. It wasn't a question of going down and having lunch and having a good natter about the documents that you'd seen. You just didn't. You didn't talk about work. The people who worked in your office and in the main, in your section, had a very sound idea of what was going on because the work was kind of interleaved. You know, the index covered Italian, German, Japanese. And one would go into the index room to pass on the day's work kind of thing. And there were indexers who would not be low-level index clerks, but they would be people of considerable discernment who would know whether you had picked out important pieces from the documents you'd been handling, or whether, in fact, they should be sent back to you for additional supplementary translation. So you went into the office at 8 o'clock, and coffee was served within the office. The office staff were a varied crowd. In addition to Leonard Forster and Hubert Potter Earle and Commander Tandy, there was an administrative sidekick by the name of Valerie Travis, who in fact was the daughter of the Travis who at one point was director of Bletchley Park. She worked with Commander Tandy. There was a rather rotund RAF officer by the name of Baggino, Bagino, commonly known and addressed as BAGS, there were two or three of the people, of the assessors, who went through the work that we had done and sifted the priorities of it before it went into the index. There was an English class who had spent a number of years in Germany and was totally bilingual, by the name of Vivian Jabez Smith. She was naval.
Jabez,
J-A-B-E-Z hyphen Smith. And she was a great influence for good. She was rather a masculine person with something of a hoarse laugh. She was great fun. She had her feet squarely on the ground. She was very capable, very efficient, and the kind of naturally reliable person to whom you could go for a bit of sanity if life was getting too much. There was a young secretary, I remember, who had lost a greatly loved fiancé in the Dieppe raid, a Canadian. She was English, he was Canadian. And there was a young sprig of the aristocracy who was a Wren rating, who sported an amazing sapphire and diamond ring, huge, which had originally graced the finger of her grandmother, and was absolutely determined to spend the rest of her mortal life on love in a garret with her artist fiancé. It was a very mixed group. There was an extremely clever girl whose first name was Dionne, D-I-O-N-E, and who was curiously disfigured, I remember, and therefore a wee bit belligerent, but extremely good at the work in hand. And there was another lovely girl by the name of Olive Brown, a Scots girl whose father had held a tiny, managed rather, owned a tiny corner shop in a small town in Scotland. She was beautiful and she was also charming. She was a linguist and she was a very gifted Scottish country dancer. This was one of the reliefs of Bletchley Park. In the early days, when the numbers had been small, and in a way the group of people had been homogeneous, there had been an amazing spirit of camaraderie. It was the kind of situation in which, because it was a small group, you made your own entertainment, and they did in a big way, and they put on variety shows, and they did all sorts of things together. Mm. Quite inevitably, as the months went by and the numbers expanded more and more, and the secrecy element meant that you didn't easily mix, then that, I think, it probably remained among the original people, but it was not accessible in anything like the same way to the latecomers. Partly, of course, because we were billeted a distance away and dependent on official transport, so you didn't stay in for things in the evening at all. But one thing that I do remember very clearly was fantastic Scottish country dancing classes led by Hugh Foss, who, in addition to being a brilliant codebreaker, was a name to be conjured with in Scottish country dancing circles in Scotland. I mean, you say Hugh Foss even now, and you know there's a certain reverential air that descends.
That's F-O-S-S, is it?
F-O-S-S, yes. And that was one place where one met others from outside one's unit. Other than that, in quite a measure, you were confined to your own unit. You went into the office and you pitched in on the work that was there to be done, whatever it happened to be for the day, either translating or reviewing documents. I mean, if you didn't actually translate and there was something that was not obviously as important as that, you would be required to write a brief review or synopsis of the thing. And, you know, there were the usual coffee breaks, and then we trundled over to the canteen in the middle of the shift. That was a real hardship if one was on night duty. It was sheer hell because the shift rotated weekly. It wasn't as if you had 3 months on nights and 3 months on this, that, or the next thing. You changed weekly. And the 2 daytime shifts were fine because it meant that you had a date. If you finished at 4, you were home by 4:30. And particularly as the evenings were light, you had time to yourself. Part of which I filled by taking piano lessons. There was a wonderful family in Newport Pagnell who were a salvation to many of us. They were called Garrett, Mr. and Mrs. Garrett. He worked at Wolverton for the Railway Administration, not yet British Rail, but Wolverton was a big marshalling station. His great passion was music. He was organist in the local church, and he had a number of Betchleyites as pupils. And his wife, whose name was Grace, and who always featured in my thinking as Grace, the wife of Orlando the Marmalade Cat, you know. She was kindly, she was mellow, she was gentle, she was very caring. And she solved my bathing problem for me. There was always hot water. And somehow, even through all the rationing, she always managed to have homemade cookies and so on for us as we went in. Other than that, in spare time, Carmen Blacker, the Japanese expert, and I, knowing that we were going back to the university, we used to study together to keep each other in harness, you know, in either her billets or mine. But in the park, I don't ever remember the time hanging as far as work was concerned. I don't ever remember being bored. I don't ever remember, and this is something that really, from my perspective now, amazes me. I don't ever remember the idea of challenging that I was doing active war work. Partly, I think, because by this time my eldest brother, electrical engineer, was engaged on work of vital military importance, and my younger brother was already in Burma serving with Rini. And there had been, from the time when the war began, when basically I was still a child, the position had been that the war had been thrust upon us, and we went into it in order to deal with a massive evil and to protect our country and its standards of freedom and so on. And in Bletchley Park, there was certainly always this feeling of immediacy. We did know that what we were doing was of vital importance to men and women at the front or at the searchlight batteries or wherever. And so it wasn't really until I met Todd that I ever began to channel my own kind of automatic progress into a war machine. Partly also, of course, because we were not waging war, and partly because the statistics that were coming through to us were of enemy casualties and not of ours. And I'm sure that has an impact too. The night shifts I hated, because one, you simply couldn't sleep in the daytime. And as I say, the rotation was so rapid that your body never got used to that. I didn't do night shifts for all that long. Because of the particular time at which I went into Bletchley. By the time I got there, there was already this great feedback of information from the continent, from the invading army, and therefore our section was not on night shift for the whole of my time there. What we were doing at the beginning of my time there, one of the other assignments that Naval Section 6 had was the handling of what were known as hand codes. There were, in fact, 27 various German naval hand codes. And these were used by ships at sea, by isolated posts, occasionally by the more senior centres, where for some reason the Enigma machine was out of action, or where the particular small unit didn't have an Enigma machine, or for some other reason that meant that they could not solely use Enigma. Of these, one of the most important, and which went on being broken for the longest, was called Henno, H-E-N-N-O. The difference, the massive difference between hand codes and machine codes was this. The hand codes were set up in columns of five letters, you know, either today, T-O-D-A-Y, second line, W-E-A-R-E, G-O-I-N-G, or alternatively, today, W-E-A-R-E, crossways, but in columns of five letters. And the cipher clerk had a book which told him, if you want to say, we are about to invade Gdansk, then you substitute these letters for the ones that occur in clear. And sometimes they were complex codes, which meant that you would do a double substitution. For example, you wouldn't take the first letter and substitute it. You would take two letters and substitute the two as a pair and so on. But in spite of that fact, because they worked on code books, A, they were not anything like as complex as the Enigma machine, and B, in a number of instances, they were not changed as frequently as the wheels on the Enigma machine. So, and not only that, but quite a number of less secrecy important messages were sent, like weather forecasts, like personnel at certain bases, this kind of thing. But the Germans were quite amazingly negligent, I think, in that very often the wording would follow an exact pattern. So that if you were receiving a message in Henno at 4:40 in the afternoon, it came to the point where you would have a jolly good idea that it would be a weather report and that it would start with something like OKW, which was Oberkommando des Kriegs, der Wehrmacht. And they would use that very frequently. Not only that, but it very quickly became clear that in the German language, the letter E is strongly predominant. And quite often, amazingly often, somewhere in the message or at the end of the message would be the words Heil Hitler. And so by dint of experience and repetition of the type of message, hand codes could be broken. And they, of course, would serve as fantastic cribs for Enigma. Because if you knew that there was going to be a certain troop movement in a certain place and you picked it up from one of the hand codes, that could go through to the Enigma codebreakers and they would be looking for some kind of comment on it over the machine ciphers. And so they, for quite a considerable period of time, they played a significant part in the work of Pietri. And when the time came, as the Second Front made its advances, where discussion arose about dropping the code breaking on these hand codes, from certain quarters there was very strong opposition to it. But by that time, of course, the pressure on skills and staff and so on was concentrated so intensively on the main line, and Enigma was producing such amazing intelligence, which meant that for whole chunks of the war, the field commanders of the Allied forces were being briefed within minutes of the German high command getting their orders. It was quite an extraordinary thing. But that also was done in Section 6. And so I did have, in the early stages, an element of code breaking, which was very exciting. And it's quite curious because you now find yourself, if you're kind of given an anagram to break, you kind of switch back into code breaking mode, this kind of thing.
Did you ever get any idea of sort of personality behind these hand codes as well? That there was a certain person.
Oh, yes. It came through in mistakes. I mean, for example, there was one occasion when a long message had been transmitted, a long message, very painstakingly, and by the time it was received by the German recipient, a lot of it was corrupt. And the recipient asked for a repeat. And the crypt clerk was mad, and he redid it, and he failed deliberately to change any of the wording, which meant that the same long message came through, essentially acting as a crib for each other, and that was one of the big helps on the way to machine breaking. Also, of course, with the passage of time, code books were actually captured. There was this amazing story that came up on the television series about a submarine that was captured, and the British officer who was sent onto it with his sidekick to pick up anything that could be of value went through the whole thing with a fine tooth comb, and the only thing that he could find was a buff envelope, and he thought, well, you know, that can't be anything. I'll take it because I've got nothing else to take. And it was a code book, which was proved enormously important, right the way up the line kind of thing, the hand codes and otherwise. So, as I said, I was never bored. I never felt that that my time was being wasted. I was very conscious that my German was being improved all the time, across a range of vocabulary that would never have come my way in the ordinary case. I mean, being me and a total uneducated scientist, although I would have been a willing scientist, but I had no expertise. But, you know, to know the ins and outs of pressure chambers and torpedoes and all this kind of thing, it was quite something.
Were you given sort of extra special dictionaries?
Yes, we
in this
not
job?
Dictionaries, we were given vocabulary lists, which had also been compiled by the indexers over the whole period of Bletchley's existence.
That seems a very important job from what you're saying, the indexes.
It was one of the major reference resources for the whole of Bletchley Park. Bletchley Park, I should say, was, it had been clearly a very gracious and pleasant place in which to live. There was a lake on which in certain winters the Bletchleyites skated and so on. It also was quite extensive, and in order to accommodate people in a hurry, what had happened was that a series of long, relatively narrow huts had been built, wooden in the first instances, but as the war went on, they were reinforced with brick interiors or what have you, and wooden shutters, of course, on account of the blackout. The floor, it was really very Spartan, in that there was heating in the winter, which was a great boon and a blessing, but the floor, I mean, the idea of, you know, lush carpeting, such as one walked into in banks and so on nowadays, absolutely out. The furniture was basic. Of course, computers really came to life during that period. They were not a feature of office work or admin or record keeping in any way. All of this was done by hand. And so conditions were really extremely simple, and such as were readily accepted in those days, that I find myself wondering if, and God forbid there were to be another war, if similar conditions would be accepted. We went on one occasion and were shown over, recently, Hellfire Corner under the coast of Dover, where there is a massive, massive tunnelling going back to the Napoleonic era, which was revived extended in order to take casualties in the Second World War. And the conditions in which surgeons and medical staff worked were unbelievably primitive. And even, you know, having lived through that era, having done a war job, I found myself saying to our hostess at that time, I can't imagine youngsters actually accepting this today. It would be so alien to them. It's very definitely, in many ways, a different world. Anyway, the end of the war was coming and came.
Oh, yes, before we get to the end of the war, you mentioned Colossus. Did you see it yourself?
Yes, I have seen Colossus.
Yes, could you describe it?
No, I really can't in any respectable way. It was an enormous computer. When one thinks of the little laptop top computers that are available nowadays, it occupied a great, massive wall space in one of the huts. And to me, as a total outsider, it just looked monumentally complicated, with wires and plugs and sockets and lights and so on and so forth. I would have no idea of what they all were.
But no, that's really, the appearance, you know, that's what I really meant.
Yes. Well,
that's
it
a
was
good description.
Ceiling, wall to wall, in this large room, in the same kind of way that they... Bombs, B-O-M-B-E's, which were introduced for work at Bletchley, and which really assisted in a huge way to make manageable this terrible problem of thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of alternatives on every setting. They were created, and again, I don't know how, but they were circular things on a large board. I should think about, you know, kind of 6 inches in diameter and raised possibly 3.5 to 4 inches. And somehow you could plug and cross-plug so that at huge speed they would run through the alternatives that were presenting on the Enigma machines. Amazing. And the dreadful, dreadful thing was, at the end of the war, thinking of secrecy, Churchill ordered them destroyed. But money has now been made available to make a museum at Bletchley Park, and they are being reconstructed, which I think is so important, because it was unique and stupendous what the top levels at Bletchley Park did. It was amazing. Anyway, summer of 1945.
There's a lot of interesting experience to go through, Beryl. But can I ask you a few more questions about Bletchley Park? You've mentioned quite a few of the people there. How about this sort of elite? Would you describe them as elitist group, this first group that was there?
I never encountered them, Lynn. Never met them.
Would they have been about, though, at your time?
Oh, yes, indeed, because they were the absolute nucleus of the continuing breaking of Enigma. They would have been. And who can I think of? Hugh Foss, for one. Alec Dakin was another. He was a splendid Yorkshireman, whom I got to know through Scottish country dancing. He was a delightful person with whom I had numerous marvellous discussions on which we were usually on opposing sides, but we enjoyed kind of sparking ideas off each other.